Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Everybody in the room already knows, but I have to tell everybody on the internet, who will tune in this week to our midweek service, expecting to hear Tim's mellifluous voice. I worked the word mellifluous into a sentence. Tim has gone through two lessons so far in his church and family series, and the feedback's been very good, and people have been enjoying it thoroughly, including myself. And then Saturday night, Tim was working on a job and decided to put a drill through his wrist. There's really no other explanation for it. And so off to the emergency room and, you know, doctor appointments and everything else. So he's here tonight, but he called me yesterday and said, I'm a little concerned because, can I go ahead and say that you're drugged out of your gourd? Is that okay? And so, he's on some pain pills and things. And so between the work and the injury and everything else, he was trying to prepare and trying to get ready. And then he called me and said, I feel concerned that perhaps my thinking ability and preparation is not. Is that fair? Did I get all that right?
The mind is cloudy.
The mind is cloudy, says Tim.
I'll be happy to be back in the settlement.
So Tim will be back next week to continue his church and family series, which has been very good. But he called and said, I apologize, but. And I said, you apologize for making me do my job? So we are going to go ahead tonight and start 2 Samuel, which is where we left off in the Old Testament. And then Tim will pick up again. And I said to Tim, you know, even if it turns out that for the next several weeks, months, years, whatever it is, if we bounce back and forth on Wednesday nights, I'm okay with that too, because each of these series are in different folders on the website and people can follow those individual series. And so I'm really completely fine with it. In fact, I told him, if you feel like you're finished with your series and you've spoken for as long as you think you can talk about that, and then a month from now you say, wait, I have an addendum, it's okay. We'll just keep doing it, because one of the great advantages that we have here at GCA is that we have next week. And that means that we can just continue and continue and continue. So it's a good thing. Till Jesus comes back, and then we'll quit continuing. Turn to 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel was pretty much the story of Saul and the rise of Saul. We learned about David being anointed by Samuel, but David was on the run for most of 1 Samuel and hiding out and avoiding the madness of Saul. And by the time Saul's rulership, his kingship, was over, Israel was in a tremendous amount of disarray. There was a lot of political intrigue going on, different groups that were fighting with different groups within Israel. I know, and it's a drag. And there was a lot of infighting, political fighting. We're going to see that at the beginning of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel starts with a bang. It just starts with, boy, is there a lot of trouble in Israel. I think sometimes we get the impression that because God was for David and had anointed David and chosen him to be king, that when Saul died, we think of David as just sort of walking into the rulership and everybody going, well, there's David, we're fine. But that's not the way it happened at all. In fact, he is made king of Judah, and yet Israel, the northern tribes, Ephraim, decide to go with one of the sons of Saul, which is natural when you think about family leadership, kingship, the way it happens over in England or any place else that has kings. Usually the posterity of the king then moves into that kingship. But David then has to depend on his mighty men and his armies to go and defend him and fight for him, and there is political intrigue involved. But here's the couple of things that I want to pull out for this morning. This morning, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
It's really Sunday.
I know. I'm used to teaching on Sunday morning because Wednesday night it's Tim time. A lot of what you're going to find in 2 Samuel is also written about in the Chronicles. And after you get through 1 and 2 Samuel, get into 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, they record the succession of kings for the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom after the separation of the two kingdoms during the reign of Solomon or after Solomon dies. And so you're going to see some of this same material, and it's interesting to compare what is written in the Chronicles and what is written in 2 Samuel as they cover the same material. Sometimes you'll find slightly different bits of stories because over time cities change names. Sometimes people use different sources to get the story and write it down. It's pretty clear that whoever penned 1 and 2 Samuel, and we've talked before about the different suggestions about who has written it, but it's clear that they're writing from the perspective of having already seen all of this play out, because they already begin referring to Israel and Judah, Ephraim and Judah, as two separate nation groups, even though that doesn't happen until after Solomon is dead. And yet you're going to see David become king of Judah, and you're going to see Saul's son become king of Ephraim in the northern. So you're already seeing the separation happening, and the writer already sees that. Now, the writer of the Chronicles, whatever sources he was using as he was recording it, oftentimes will tell the same story in parallel. Sometimes he'll change little details, and sometimes the details that change are absolutely fascinating and theologically significant. For instance, 2 Samuel ends with the story of God being angry with Israel. And so we read in Samuel's account, well, in the account of 2 Samuel, that God stirred up David to number the people because he was angry at Israel. And then God punishes David and all Israel for the fact that David numbered the people, because that process of numbering was a way of showing ownership, that David wanted to know what population he was ruling over. How many mighty men did he have? How big would his army be? And so it was an indication that David thought that these people belonged to him. And so God was angry at Israel, so he stirred up David to count the people. And then when David did it, even though some of his counselors said, don't do this, this is a really bad idea, and then he did it anyway, and then God punishes him for it, gives him three options, and then David chooses the option where Israel falls into God's hands rather than into the hands of their enemies or into the hands of famine. David at least counts on God, hopefully, to be merciful to some degree and says, well, let's take option three and will be in your hands and all this. Now you go to the Chronicles and you read the exact same story, and the account is pretty much verbatim. It's pretty much right down the line, same story. Except for one little thing. In the Chronicles it says that Satan stirred up David to count the people, which is a really interesting little theological tidbit, because it's hard for us to imagine God being angry with Israel and then stirring up David to do something that he's going to punish David for having done. That's a really difficult version of God for us to conceive of, even though it comes under the headship of God's sovereignty, and even though it works in the big theological format of compatibilism. Still, we have to ask, well, how is it that God tempted David to do something God would punish David for, especially considering that in the New Testament, James says that when you're tempted, don't say God tempted you, because God tempts no man. And yet at the end of 2 Samuel, we read God apparently doing that, until we get to the Chronicles and find out that God, who is in sovereign control of all things, including being in control of Satan, sent Satan to do the dirty work and accomplish his ultimate end. That's real sovereignty. So even as we're reading through this book, that a large portion of it is narrative, a large portion of it is history, you're also going to see David a couple times break out into what are called songs that are really versions of what we would call psalms. Stories put in poetic form, prose written by David in order to be passed down from generation to generation. And you're also going to see the very consistent personality profile of David. And you're going to find out that he's exactly, in so many ways, like Jamie and Conrad and Tim little less cloudy-headed than Tim. He's very much like Jeff. He's a human. And humans across the board don't do well with limitless choice. We've talked about this a lot through the years. You know, I've oftentimes thought it would be great to win the lottery. I finally figured out why I've never won. I never bought a ticket, which could be what's hampering my winning ability. But I've often thought, boy, wouldn't it just be great if, you know, somebody who loved GCA won the lottery and decided to tithe or something. You know, wouldn't it just be great if somebody... Wouldn't it be great if we had enough money to do all the things I want to do? Wouldn't it be great if we could build a bigger building? Wouldn't it be great if some of the men who have been so faithful all these years could be on staff here? And wouldn't it just, all the great things we could do, and wouldn't it be good to pay off all the bills? I'd love to have my house paid off. I'd love to have no monthly bills. I'd love to have, and then I remember what I'm like. In Izzy's words, it's me. I remember those times in my life when I ever did have options, and the vast majority of the time I chose bad, really bad, because it's me. And humans are like that. The history of Israel is that every time they get comfortable, every time God plants them in their land, takes care of their enemies, gives them plenty of food, gives them rain and plenty of crops, that's when they apostatize every single time. That's the consistent history. And then God has to punish them, and so he brings in the enemies again, and the enemies conquer Israel, and then Israel cries out to God and says, we've sinned against you, please help your people, please remember us. And then he would send a judge, and that's what the whole book of Judges was about. And he would send them a conqueror who would come in and fight for them and defeat the Philistines and run off the enemies. And then for about a generation, Israel would be good again. And then... I agree. She's just testifying. That's all that is. And then about a generation would go by where they would be faithful to God again. And the next generation would come along who didn't remember what God had done. And then they would start getting fat and happy. And then they would start rebelling again and doing their own thing and going their own way. Because human beings do not do well with choice, with success. They can't handle success. You know, Paul writes about that in the context of him talking about I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, which is so horribly badly abused by so many evangelicals who want to say that what that verse means is I can do whatever I want because I can do all things through Christ and he strengthens me. Therefore, I can go out and proclaim things wildly. But contextually, what Paul said is I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. And then he said, and I have found in all things to be content. In every state I'm in to be content. He said, I know how to suffer lack, and I know how to be full. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Now that's really interesting language because we in America, where we are so spoiled and have been so fortunate and have lived in such a wealthy society for so long, that we think to really endure would be to endure lack. That if we ever got poor or we ever went hungry, that's when you would really need to be able to endure and not lose your faith in God or in Christ, even though you had suffered this way. But the reality is, people also cannot, for the most part, endure wealth. It will destroy them because they become self-sufficient. What's the story that Jesus told about the man who had so many crops and everything was growing so well for him that he built bigger barns, and once he had built bigger barns, had his silos full of everything, his response was, take rest, my soul. I have plenty. I'm in need of nothing. And Jesus said, and God will say to him, you fool, this day your soul will be required of you. Now, what's a man going to give in exchange for his soul? And so human beings don't do well with limitless choice. That's my point. It happened to Saul when he became king, even though God said, when I give you a king, he's going to take the best of everything and the best horses. He's going to take the best women. He's going to take your young men and your young women. He's going to make them servants and slaves to him. He's going to tax you. He's going to take all your stuff. And they all said, that's okay. We just want a king anyway. That's good with us. Vote Obama. And they... I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? Okay. And so then when Saul is gone and David becomes king, David finally, instead of having to be reliant on God for his very well-being, just for food, just for daily sustenance, now has everything. And he has, as we're going to see tonight, multiple wives through whom he has multiple children. And yet, in 2 Samuel, we're going to hear about David's greatest failing. There was one more woman he couldn't have. And like typical humans, and far too often like typical men, it was, well, then I want that one. And he's going to commit murder, and God is going to punish him for it. Because, like I said, he's just like us. Now, I really like the fact that the Bible is willing to tell us that Abraham lied. I like that we find that out about him. I like the fact that we find out, they don't sugarcoat it, that Moses did kill an Egyptian and have to run and hide in the wilderness for 40 years. I like the fact that we find out that David was an adulterer and a murderer and still called the man after God's own heart. Because it is never the human who is the reason for the relationship between God and the human. It is always God in his faithfulness, in his consistency, who is the reason and the cause for the relationship. There is no way that any of us humans, because we're us, could ever sustain an ongoing relationship with a holy, righteous, eternal God. There's no way that we could ever live up to the least standard he might set. If he says, okay, we're going to have a relationship now, provided you, and it can be something simple, provided you show up regularly with cookies, just anything. It can be something mundane. It could be something, and eventually human beings, because we're so egocentric, because we're so self-involved, will at some point decide, you know, he probably didn't mean cookies. How long did it take before the sons of the priests decided he didn't mean that whole strange fire thing? He told us what kind of mixture to bring in when we burn the incense in front of him, but we could probably improve on that. The Bible is just chock full of these kinds of stories. Peter's failures, Paul having to withstand him to his face because he was to be blamed, or his three times denying that he even knew who Jesus was. And yet Jesus shows up, comes to Peter, and three times says, do you love me? Now when you're converted, strengthen your brethren. And chose Peter, of all people, to preach the message at the day of Pentecost. So always, 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 throughout the Bible, you see the consistent testimony that even the best of people, even the Old Testament heroes, even the Abrahams and the Moses and the David, they are nevertheless still flesh and blood people with feet of clay. And they still fail all the time. And they don't just fail, they fail big.
Not Mohammed.
I'm not even going there.
That's one of those also self-authenticating principles of the Bible in our faith, is that, you know, people, you know, would say, oh, just a bunch of men making up some faith to rule people. And you don't find other faiths where our heroes are, you know, we're going to pretty much make us look the way we do. Yeah. You know, they're all fail. They all fail.
Right.
They all get in trouble.
That's one of the strongest arguments for the legitimacy of the Bible, is that if it was written by men who were just creating a religion, as you said, look at the other religious literature. When they write about their heroes, they talk about the perfection of their heroes. And if some bit of historic accuracy slipped in where you could find out that they were failures, they'll usually extricate those in later versions of the rewrites to make sure that nobody ever knows, so that when you look back on the heroes of the particular religion, you think, wow, these guys were just great and perfect. But the Bible continues to tell the same story in over over and over again, which is that human beings are just no darn good, and that God is just really that good and that faithful, and that everybody who has had a relationship with God, it's because God chose them, and God sustained them, and God causes them to persevere, and God is faithful to them. And I take great, great comfort in reading about David. And I take great comfort in reading about Peter, because I'm like Peter. I'm as prone as anybody to just stick my sandal in my mouth and keep talking. So the other thing we're going to see in 2 Samuel, these are all just introductory notes, and then we'll jump in and see how far we get. But the other thing that's going to happen in 2 Samuel is one of the most important developments in the Old Testament, the Davidic covenant. God told Abraham that through his seed, all the nations of the earth were going to be blessed. But even before that, God told Satan that the seed of the woman was going to crush the head of the serpent, and that it was going to crush his head and bruise his heel, what's called the proto-evangelion, the proto-evangel, the first telling of the gospel story. But the details aren't really fleshed out. It's just seed of the woman, seed of the serpent, and the seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent. And then you get to Abraham, and you see the promise that through his seed in particular now, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And now God narrows it down yet again and tells David, okay, now it's going to be through your lineage. So he's really narrowing down the whole seed concept that you can follow throughout the Old Testament, and then says it's going to be your particular seed who is going to sit on a throne and rule Israel forever. Boy, this sure fits into the new covenant stuff we've been talking about on Sundays. And so finally, in the Old Testament, in the Davidic covenant, you're getting the indication that there is going to be a forever kingdom someday, and it's going to be a direct descendant of David who's going to sit on that throne. And that helps us understand why one of the phrases that was used to describe Jesus, especially like on the day of the triumphal entry when he entered into Jerusalem and they threw their cloaks and their palm branches down in front of the donkey that was carrying him, they cried out, "Hosanna to the Son of David." That particular nomenclature was them recognizing, you're the descendant of David who is going to usher in the everlasting kingdom based on the promise, the covenant that's established back here in 2 Samuel. So there's a lot going on in this book. There's theology and there's history, and it starts with a fella coming to David and telling David that Saul is dead. Now, what you need to know is this guy's lying, because by the time you get to chapter 4, you're going to see David's perspective on this guy and his story. But let's start by looking at the end of 1 Samuel and look at the death of Saul. Start in verse 3. Of chapter 31, the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword, and Saul fell on it. So what you see there is Saul falling on his own sword rather than letting himself be turned over while still alive to the Philistines. He didn't want to be made sport of, and he didn't want to die at their hands. He asked his armor bearer to kill him. His armor bearer wouldn't do it for fear, a good reverent fear, as we're about to see at the beginning of the next book. And so he committed suicide. Now, David is going to return from Ziklag in chapter 1, verse 1 of 2 Samuel. It came about after the death of Saul that David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. Do you remember Ziklag? That was the city that he was given to live in. They had been out, David and his men had been out, and they came back, and the city had been burned, and their wives and their children, their cattle, everything had been taken. And so he chased after the Amalekites, and he conquered them, and he brought back the women, and he brought back the children and the animals, and this is the city of Ziklag. So he goes back there, and he remained 2 days there, and it happened on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. Now, this is sort of a little Hebraism you have to be familiar with. If a messenger is bringing bad news, before he would walk in to tell the commander, the general, the king, he wouldn't walk in looking fresh and sparkly. He would throw dirt on his head, and he would tear his clothes, rent his clothes, usually a sign of grieving. And so when he came, the king would already know that this guy's carrying bad news, but he already looks like he's penitent over the fact that he's carrying bad news. So it happened on the third day that a man came out from the camp of Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell on the ground and he prostrated himself. And David said to him, "From where do you come?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did things go? Please tell me." And he said, "The people have fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." Pretty bad news. So David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear." In other words, he was dying, being held up by clinging to his spear. "And behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. And when he looked behind me, he saw me and he called to me, and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.'" He was probably, I'll tell you, he was probably living among the Jews at that point, and it was not uncommon for foreigners to fight with other armies. And so he was probably an Amalekite fighting for Israel at that point. "So who are you?" "I'm an Amalekite." And then he said to me, "Please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me, because my life still lingers in me." So I stood beside him, and I killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. Okay, now that's interesting, because we read nothing about that at the end of 1 Samuel. Now, 1 and 2 Samuel originally were one book. There are early versions of it where it's just one continuous narrative. And that means that the original writer juxtaposed these two stories against each other on purpose. First, he told you how Saul died, and then he tells you the story of the Amalekite talking to David, so that you would get the fact that the Amalekite is not telling a genuine story. But now look at what this guy does. He's trying to win favor with David because he recognizes that David is likely to be the next king. So he's expecting David to be happy that this guy killed Saul, his enemy. "Look, I took care of your enemy for you. I killed him for you. And not only that, I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I've brought them here to you, my lord." Here, that's good, right? I done a good thing, right? Well, we're going to find out in a minute that David is going to kill this guy for it because of the way that he went about doing this. But chances are the real story is probably that he stumbled across the dead body of Saul before they had a chance to bury the body, and then he took the crown and the bracelet, which was probably one of those around the upper arm kind of bands, and would have taken the band and the crown, and then having that in his hand thought, "Wait, I can use this to my own advantage. If I take this to David, he'll probably make me a general, or set me up in a beautiful house, or maybe I'll become a counselor to the king, or something good is definitely going to come of this. In fact, I'm going to need to explain why I have the crown and the bracelet. I got it. I'm going to say I killed Saul." Verse 11, "David then took a hold of his own clothes and he tore them. And so also did all the men that were with him. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul." That's probably not what the Amalekite was expecting. "They fasted and they mourned and they wept for Saul and for his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and for the whole house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword." So there's a lot of bad news here. Israel lost the war, Israel's fallen by the sword, and on top of that, the king is dead and the king's son is dead. And remember, Jonathan was a very close friend to David, as he's going to write in a moment. And David said to the young man who told him all this, "Where are you from?" And he said, "I am the son of an alien. I am an Amalekite." Then David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Now, this is fascinating. Do you remember when David snuck into the camp where Saul was, took Saul's spear, and David's cousin was with him and said, or was it his nephew that was with him, and said, "Well, now you've got his spear, and here he is. He's laying on the ground defenseless. Take him out." And David said, "I can't touch the Lord's anointed. It's God who made him king. It's not for me to upset what God has decided to do. Essentially, if God has decided I'm going to be king, I'm going to be king. But it's going to be God that does it, not my hand. I'm not going to kill him. He is the Lord's anointed." And so instead, he takes the spear and he takes the jug that was right by his head. And then he goes to the hill and he yells. And he calls out to those that were supposed to be guarding Saul. And he castigates them for allowing him to get that close to Saul. He says, "How is it that you didn't guard your king?" Now, of course, David also has a vested interest here because he's going to be king. And so he wants to set a standard where the king is always protected. But more importantly, David's attitude, David's perspective on Saul, even though Saul was trying to kill him, even though he was on the run for his life from Saul, God's sovereignty still trumped David's circumstances. And David would not lay his hand against the one that was anointed by God. And so when the king of Israel died, yet again we find David saying to the young man, "You just said you killed Saul." Of course, we also know this is a lie. "You said you killed Saul. Why weren't you afraid to do that?" Now, either way, we know that Saul was wounded. He'd been wounded by the archers. He's leaning on his staff. He's dying anyway. And David still says, "You're guilty because you killed the Lord's anointed." Because his attitude was always, God is sovereignly in control of what happens here in Israel. It's not for any man to take it into their own hands in order to attempt to accomplish their own will against what God has anointed to be done, what God has determined to be done. I'm going to apply this for a moment because I'm just not a political guy, but we find ourselves in the midst of a political election right now. And people are as divided as they can be about whether it's going to be Obama or whether it's going to be Romney. And there's a lot of hand-wringing going on. And there are a lot of people who are afraid that if Obama gets 4 more years, it's going to destroy the United States. And there are a lot of people who are concerned that if Romney becomes president, then he's going to undo all of the social change that has happened recently that they find to be favorable. There's all this concern and worry about which man is going to lead America for the next 4 years and who can save us. No human being can save us. All the way back here, Israel is going to go through a succession of kings, good kings, bad kings, better kings, worse kings. The history of the world has been that there have been good leaders and there have been bad leaders. And there have been the Hitlers and the Pol Pots and there have been the, you know, the communist uprisings and stuff. And there have also been the Great Awakening and there's also been the Reformation, and there's also been the good and the bad of what happens here on planet Earth. But the simple reality is every generation of people has looked to some other person, some other man, and hoped that maybe this was going to be the leader that was going to save them, that was going to fix them, that was going to make it okay. Saul was a bad king, and God said, "I'm going to give you a king who's just going to be nothing but trouble for you." And they wanted it, and so God gave him Saul, who was a really messed up king. And then when his time in office was over, God then gives him a king after his own heart, a man after God's own heart. Now you're going to have this king. Did that fix Israel? No, that didn't fix Israel. There's only one king I'm really concerned about. And there's only one leader on one throne who can actually save us. And until the Prince of Peace comes back, the Bible is clear that there's going to be no peace. In fact, it's going to be when they say peace and safety. It's going to be when they say peace, peace, and there is no peace, while they're busy saying it's all okay. Then comes sudden destruction, because the real ruler, the real king, is still on his throne and still ruling. So I said all that to say, I'm going to vote. I'm going to vote my Christian conscience. But that's really hard to do this year. The choices are a man who I don't think should have another 4 years, or a Mormon who I have my questions about. So I'm going to vote my Christian conscience as best I can in this situation. But here's what I know for sure. Whoever becomes our next president, God is still on his throne. And if it turns out that our next president, whether that's Obama or Romney, if it turns out that they only make things worse, it won't surprise me, because I personally see our two choices as part of God's ongoing judgment against the United States. And as this country continues to devolve from the once great Christian nation it was, we're just going to see more and more of God taking his hand further and further off. Look throughout the Bible. What was always the sign of God's judgment? He removed himself. When God was in the midst of people, those people thrived. But when God wanted to punish people, he removed himself from those people. He let them do what they wanted to do, and usually what they wanted to do was go get a king. And they thought that was going to solve their problems. But unless God intervenes, Romney's not going to save us. And if God is sovereignly in control as he is, Obama can only do as much damage as God will let him do. But we'll be okay because we're children of the king. And in the end, I'm not looking for an earthly kingdom till he comes back and establishes the kingdom that will never end. That's when there will finally be justice and righteousness and holiness on the planet. And not before, because there's no human being who can bring us the things that we crave, like righteousness and justice and holiness in the earth. No man can do it. And they couldn't do it in David's time, is my point. And how long ago was that? And human beings have been going through these machinations ever since. So my point is, and I do have one, David said, this is the Lord's anointed. Why weren't you afraid to kill him? Why would you impose yourself into the plan of God this way? Encroachment is one of the chief examples of our carnality. We as human beings love to encroach in places where we have neither the leave nor the warrant. We've always been that way. We've always done it ever since. Don't touch that. Oh, I think I'll touch that. And that has been our problem ever since. We want to encroach on things that God has said belong to him. And we want to impose ourselves, and we want to do things our way, and we want to exercise our ego. And what we refuse to do is just do things God's way, because we're us. So he said, where are you from? I'm an Amalekite. How is it that you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called one of the young men and said, go cut him down. So he struck him and he died. And David said to him, your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Do you realize, if the Amalekite hadn't lied, he wouldn't have been killed? Now, like I said, in a couple chapters, David's going to hearken back to this event, and he's going to say, he thought he'd get a reward from me. And so we know that even David saw through it. So let's just finish this chapter. David then chanted, or he recited. This is going to be a song or a psalm. He chanted with his lament over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. And behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. This is not the apocryphal book of Jasher. This is a book of the Chronicles of the Kings. Essentially, we don't have it. It's gone to antiquity. But the kings always had scribes who just kind of kept track of the great actions of the king. And that was apparently the book that this was in. And here's what he wrote. I'll just read it out. "Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet and put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished?" Chapter 2, then, where we'll start next time I'm standing here on a Wednesday night, whenever that may be, will be David's installation as the king of Judah, the southern kingdom. And then you're going to see the northern tribes follow after the son of Saul, and the political intrigue begins. That's the introduction to 2 Samuel. Any questions about that? All right, pray for Tim so he can be standing here next week, because I want to hear the next installment in his series. And Gladys's concern was, but did you get the job finished? You need to make her a foreman, is what you need to do. All right.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.